Well, good morning. It's good to see you all this morning. Missed you last week. We were unable to watch on live stream when we were out of town. We didn't actually have any internet access over there, which was actually very nice to have. But I trust everything went very well. But it's good to be back with you today. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 9. So if you could turn over there for me. And we will pick up where we were before. If you didn't get a handout, you walked in this morning and you didn't get a handout, raise your hand and we'll make sure you got one. If you didn't get one of our outlines, one over there. Okay, I think we did good on that. Thank you, Brother Collette. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 9. I remind you each week about where we are in the book of Jeremiah on the very front of your handout. And I do that on purpose because I don't want us to see the Bible as just a random conglomeration of interesting thoughts. Okay, especially with prophets, especially with letters, there is a flow of thought that is taking place. And when we rip statements out of the Bible, we can use them inappropriately or have no idea what's going on. And the major prophets are easier to do that with, aren't they? Because you can kind of get lost in the woods as you're going through all of the different chapters. And so I want us to follow along with what's happening. Jeremiah is preaching to the nation of Judah. The northern tribes of Israel in the nation of Israel have already been taken away captive because of their sin. And the nation of Judah is still there. And they have doing the same things the northern tribes have done, and so he's preaching against them to tell them what they need to change. He spends most of the beginning of his book, chapters 2 through 15, really laying this indictment against them, and he does so in a series of different sermons. And so I gave you those different sermons, the general areas where they are, and we're on sermon number 3, which we call the temple sermon. He preaches this sermon at the temple. We've already established in the 2 sermons beforehand that these people are doing the wrong thing. They are wicked. They're acting like the world. And they refuse to return. They are spiritual adulterers, but they refuse to change. And so he walks down to the temple, and it's filled with people going and coming and sacrificing and praying. They're still doing all the religious things you're supposed to do. They're just not actually obeying God. And what this communicates to us, and what Jeremiah is trying to communicate to them, is that in spite of our religious rituals that we instill into our life, it doesn't undo the spiritual state of our hearts. We want to think that it does. We want to bribe God with spiritual deeds into allowing us to live as we please. And it doesn't work that way. And so he tells them that, and that they were being stubborn. He gave them an opportunity to return, but they said, no, we will stay as we are. And that's what he covers in chapter 7 through 8. And so here we are in chapter 9, where he begins to continue on a type of thing that Jeremiah would normally do. Jeremiah is known as the weeping prophet, partially because he is seen mourning for his situation more often than almost any other prophet is. Now, it might be a little unfair to call him the weeping prophet to the extent that as if Jeremiah was a crier and none of the other ones were. Jeremiah had to deal with a lot more of a sad situation than the other prophets did. Like Isaiah had to deal with a lot of sin in the nation of Israel, but there was a lot of hope in their future. And he prophesied about a lot of things that are coming down the road that God was going to do. And I mean, Isaiah prophesied during the time of Hezekiah. There was a lot of encouragement during that time. Jeremiah just preached during the time when everything was just falling apart. So he had reason to weep over what was going on. He wept because of everything that was happening, but he also wept because of the sin of the people. And we see that show up throughout this book, and chapter 9 is one of those instances where he does that. Before we get into chapter 9, very briefly, I want us to look at the very end of chapter 8. We read this last time we were here, but I want us to look at it again. I actually put this as this section of his sermon that belongs to the message we're preaching today. And so I want to read it again. Look at verse number 18 of Jeremiah chapter 8. So just up the column a little bit. After hearing about their refusal to return and to live like the world, he tries to comfort himself. Verse 18. When I would comfort myself against sorrow, my heart is faint in me. Behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people because of them that dwell in a far country. They say this, is not the Lord in Zion? Is not her king in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their graven images and with strange vanities? The people are saying, yeah, I know everything's falling apart, but isn't God still with us? And Jeremiah says, I don't know. Is he? Because you're not following after him. I guess that would be the question, wouldn't it? He says in verse 20, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. There is this sense in which it'll all turn out later on. Harvest was a harvest season that would have been in the spring, and then summer would have also yielded a harvest season at the end. So there's always this hope that we will have what we need, but now we're at winter, and we don't have what we need. Harvest past, summer's ended, and we're still not saved. Sometimes in our lives, when everything is falling apart, things aren't going well, we try to just comfort ourselves and say, it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll all turn out okay. Because that's more encouraging. It might not be true, but it's more encouraging. Verse 21, for the hurt of the daughter of my people, I am hurt. I am black. Astonishment had taken hold on me. I am black. I wear black. I mourn for what's going on. Verse 22, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? They had the resources to heal themselves. Why are they not healed, he asks. And that's one of the ways we can comfort ourselves as well. But we should be able to take care of it, right? I should be able to fix it myself, shouldn't I? And that's our first inclination. I'll deal with it on my own. When my life is falling apart, rather than turning to God, like Jeremiah was telling them, they say, well, let's turn to our own resources and see what we can come up with. Last week, I said there's three types of spiritual evaluations of our life. There's spiritual pessimists, there's spiritual optimists, and there's spiritual realists. Spiritual pessimists are people who say that God is against them every time something goes wrong. Like your car breaks down on the side of the road, and you just assume that means that God has abandoned you in life. Well, and sometimes we feel that way, don't we? Like anything, something goes wrong, God hates us. That's a spiritual pessimist. Spiritual optimist would be when our hearts are not right with God and we just want to think everything's fine when it isn't, which is also very dangerous. Jeremiah wants to be optimistic. I'm sure it'll be fine. I will comfort myself. But he didn't find it. He was a spiritual realist. Spiritual realists recognizes truthfully how deviant our heart is. There's a reason why we're very careful when we define the word confession. If you confess and forsake your sin, you'll have mercy. When we talk to kids, we often define confession specifically. The word confess, we use it to mean I said it out loud, right? Sure, there it is. Confess is less than saying out loud and more of agreeing with in your heart. When God says something, we agree with him. We see it the same way. And that's our biggest problem with our spiritual state. We don't want to agree with God that it's as bad as it really is. Because that's uncomfortable. And so what he does in chapter 9 is he begins to mourn over their situation. Mourning is uncomfortable because to mourn is to admit that there is something bad that has taken place in our life, in our heart. Funerals, for example, are uncomfortable. We didn't want the person to pass away, but they did. And we know that when we go, we can only be so happy or so light during the situation because it's a negative thing. And so funerals become very uncomfortable because the only purpose of it is to recognize something bad has happened and to mourn over it. When I was in college, so I was on the other side of the country, I was in California, my grandfather passed away. I was able to be on the phone with him briefly while he was in his last hours. But he passed away. I was in the middle of my semester, and my initial response was that I really didn't want to come to the funeral. Did I love my grandfather? Oh, I adored my grandfather. It wasn't that I didn't want to be there. It was just that I knew the only purpose of the funeral was to fly across the country to come and to mourn. And that's uncomfortable. Because we have to acknowledge something bad has happened. Now, spiritually, though, we all try to avoid uncomfortable feelings as well. People try to avoid those types of things, like I did in college, not because I didn't love my grandfather, but because I knew the only reason to be there was to mourn. Now, I did come, and it was good for me. Closure was good. But there are people, by the way, who don't come to this church, not because they don't like the music, or that the chairs aren't squishy enough, not because they don't like pastor's message, but because a loved one passed away and the funeral was held in this room. And they cannot bear to sit in this room on a regular basis. Because mourning is uncomfortable, so they avoid it. Likewise, spiritually, we often try to avoid every uncomfortable feeling. Jeremiah is preaching, you have sin and you have problems in your life, and he mourns. But to mourn is to acknowledge there's a problem. And to do that is uncomfortable. This is why a lot of people don't like to go to church. Not because they don't like people. Christians are great people to hang around. They're the people that you can laugh with, and they're the people that you can joke with. They're the people that you can trust. They're the people who are generally honest. And some Christians are really bad people, and I acknowledge that. But generally, you know, come to church. This is some of the greatest crowd that you can hang out with. But why don't people like to come to church? Because it's at church where we find out there's something wrong in our life. And that's uncomfortable. And so I'd rather think everything is fine than to mourn for my sin. So the question for us is, are we avoiding the spiritual state of our own heart, or are we facing it and dealing with it? Jeremiah has to face it. And so today, very quickly, as we walk through chapter 9, I want us to look at six ways that mourning over sin will look in our life. How will this manifest itself in our life? So number one, and we'll go through this as quickly as we can. Chapter 9 isn't ridiculously long, and I'm not quite going to finish it because the last two verses really belong as a transition to the next thought as he finishes his sermon. So we'll end in verse 24. So number one, if we mourn over our sin, we will desire to distance ourselves from sin. Distance ourselves from sin. So look at verse number 1 of chapter 9. Oh, that my head were waters, and my eyes and a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. This is a good example of why Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. He wept for the sin, he wept for the calamity, he wept for the hard-heartedness of the people. How does he react to this? Verse number 2. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them, for they be all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men. He's not asking for a palace. He's asking for a tent in the middle of nowhere. Why? Because he just wants to get away from it all. When my wife and I were in Ireland, I mentioned a minute ago, last week, my phone, I left on airplane mode the whole week, because otherwise it would, you know, be roaming, and that's bad. My wife actually bought a preloaded SD card, which she switched with the one in her phone, so that she could use it over there. Which, by the way, complete side note, worked really well. So if you ever do that, ask her, because that worked out great. So she had data and she had phone, but she didn't have her phone number anymore. So the phone number that any of you have for her did not connect to her phone. So both her and I were completely disconnected from the world. And it was like everything just stopped. And that was a glorious thing. Some of us would love to just turn off our phone and not feel bad about it. And so the guy at work's not going to call you. Nobody's going to say that something broke and you have to come and fix it. And nobody's going to come to you with a fire that you got to put out. And so that was very nice, but that's not reality. And we know it. But there are times where we feel like we just kind of want to get away from things. I mean, we all know that there's times where we get really busy and we just want to leave and go crawl in a hole and nobody's going to ask us to do anything else. Sometimes something happens like election takes place, and then suddenly we think the world's going to fall apart because of all the people that got elected. We all want to pick up, we want to move to Australia, right? And we sometimes feel that way, but that's not what he's saying here. Because that's not particularly spiritual. That initial response of things are bad, I want to move, that's selfish because we don't want to deal with the taxes and we don't want to deal with the difficulty. We don't want to deal with the responsibility that's going to be placed on our shoulders in order to react to the bad world around us. What was Jeremiah saying? I want to leave. What does he say at the end of that verse, in verse number 2? Because they are all adulterers. We think we're spiritual when we want to run away from bad difficulty, but what Jeremiah is saying is, I really want to leave the sin. If I were to ask us this question this morning, do we have a desire to run from sin? We would say yes. But then the question is, do we? Because that is a decision we make every week. This isn't something that's going to come in the future. You live in the world. You're surrounded by sin. And you every day make a decision to run from it or stay with it. Do you run from the sin on your phone? Do you run from the sin that comes out of your television? Do you run from the sin that you can choose to or not choose to surround yourself with and the people that you associate with at work or with your family? We have sin trying to infiltrate our life, and we do choose to run from it or not. Jeremiah starts this morning by saying, I wish I could be separated from all of this sin. Now, there's a balance there. Jeremiah doesn't make a tent in the middle of the wilderness and go and live there. Why? Because he has to preach to the people. Paul actually says the same thing in a book. I can't tell you which one it was, but Paul says the same thing where he says that he's torn. He wants to stay with them, but he also wants to go and be with the Lord as well. But you can't do both of them at the same time. He tells in one of his letters, he says, don't make company with adulterous and fornicating people. He says, but not all together, because then you'd have to leave the world. You know, you still have to work with the people that are around. You still have to live nearby them. And there's a balance. The question is not, have you gone and become a hermit? The question is, when the sin tries to infiltrate your life, do you distance yourself from it or not? Because to mourn from your sin is to recognize that sin is bad. And we don't want to recognize that the sin in our life is bad, so we don't mourn for it. Number 2, when we mourn for our sin, we will see sin as sin. Well, that should go without saying, shouldn't it? It should. But that's our issue. Because one of the ways we react to not having to deal with the problems in our heart is to redefine it as acceptable. So let's look at how Jeremiah sees the sin of his people. Verse number 3. We'll read down to verse number 8. He says he'd like to leave all the sin because they're adulterers. They're an assembly of treacherous men. Verse 3, he goes on, they bend their tongues like a bow for lies. That's a very vivid picture. They shoot arrows at people with their deception. They are not valiant for the truth upon the earth. They proceed from evil to evil. They know not me, saith the Lord. Take ye heed, every one of his neighbor. Trust ye not in any brother. Every brother will utterly supplant. Every neighbor will walk with slanders. They will deceive every one his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies and weary themselves to commit iniquity. That's an interesting phrase right there. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. Some people work really, really hard to do things the wrong way than to do it the right way. Verse 6. Thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will melt them and try them, like you try metal to see how much dross is in it. He's already used that picture. How shall I do for the daughter of my people? Their tongue is as an arrow shot out. It speaketh deceit. One speaketh peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in heart he layeth in his wait. So what does he do? Well, how does he define the sin of his people? He calls what they're doing lies, evil, iniquity, deceit. He talks about their gossip and their hypocrisy. He didn't call it good business that people have because they just need to make a dollar, so you just have to operate certain ways. He didn't call them white lies. He didn't call them speaking to somebody in conversation, but in their heart they were looking to do them evil. He didn't call it good conversation or covering for a friend. He called it sin. And what we want to do is we want to redefine the wickedness in our hearts and deem it to be acceptable so we don't have to mourn over it. Our fellows are coming by really quickly. If you could take that attendance slip, scratch your name on it, make sure it's there, drop that in, we'd appreciate that. Just so we know who's here in Sunday school this morning. When I was a teenager, we were out door knocking, and I came across a guy here in Dover, and I started to share the gospel with him. He was a very nice guy, he was. And so I started at the beginning. The gospel begins with God loves you, John 3:16, but that we're all sinners. You know, Romans 3:23, Romans 3:10, or wherever else you could turn in the Bible would be there. And his immediate response to we're all sinners was, well, I like to call them mistakes. Now, as a teenager, I thought, you know, whatever, words are words. Words aren't special. They're just there to communicate. So, I mean, even in the Bible, things are translated, the exact same words translated a variety of ways. And sometimes it's just for the sake of making it sound different. There's actually not a difference in idea. And so, you know, whatever, words are words. You can use whatever words you want. I'm not big on semantics. It's not really that important to me. But looking back on that, what I missed, which was so obvious, was that the guy wasn't just using a different title. Like every language has a different title for God. They use a different word for God. Hebrew and Greek use a different word for God. It wasn't that he used a different word. It was that he changed the definition. I wanted to say we all have fallen short of God's glory, and we are morally responsible for it. And he wanted to say, no, we're not perfect, but it's not really our fault. Let me give you an example. Suppose you invite me over to dinner for a T-bone steak and a baked potato and cheesecake, which would be a good idea if it comes across your mind. And I walk into your house and you have a little stand with the expensive vase sitting on top of it, whatever. And I'm talking with my hands as I normally do, and I knock over your vase. And it falls to the ground and it crashes. And so it's irreparable. It's done. I am responsible. You're not, but I am. But I'm not morally responsible for it. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't walk into your house and say, look at that vase. I will crash it. It just happened. So am I at fault? Yes. Am I morally responsible for it? No. I didn't do it on purpose. I wasn't malicious about it. But suppose you invite me over to your house for a steak and a baked potato and cheesecake, and I walk into your house and I see the vase, and I pick it up, and just for the sake of it, I throw it on the ground and it crashes into a million pieces, irreparable. Am I at fault? Yes, you're not. But am I morally responsible now? Yeah, because it was a decision that I made. At the end of the day, most people are willing to acknowledge in our life that the vase is broken on the ground. We are at fault. Most people are willing to acknowledge that. It's easy to convince somebody that you're a sinner. What's hard to convince them about is the definition of sin. Because we want to say it wasn't really my fault. Am I at fault? Yes. But am I really morally responsible for it? Well, it's just the way I was brought up. Well, it's just the way that I am. It's just the struggles that I have. It's the world we live in. It's the people that I happen to be around all the time. Yes, the vase is broken, but I didn't mean it. It's not sin. It was a mistake. And you know what we do? We don't want to mourn over our sin. Mourning is uncomfortable, so we redefine the stuff that we do in our life and our hearts, and we label it as bad, but not really our fault. We're not really morally responsible. When Jeremiah identifies the sin of the people, he doesn't use words, does he? Evil, iniquity. You shoot out your tongue like an arrow using deceit. You cannot trust your neighbor. They slander. Like, he doesn't have any harsher words than that, because that's what it was. To mourn for sin is to call sin, sin. And that is a step toward restoration, but we don't want to pass through it because it's uncomfortable. Number three, I got to move on. When we mourn for sin, we will understand the judgment of God. We will understand the judgment of God. Now, I'm not trying to say we will understand why God does all the things that he does. That's not what I'm trying to say. But God's judgment will seem to follow a little bit more than we often give him credit for. Let's read the next section, verse number 9 through verse number 16. I'll try to read through that quickly. Like he does in most of his sermons, he brings up, this is what will take place. Shall I not visit for these things, saith the Lord? Shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? We've heard that statement a few times already, haven't we? Did you not want me to respond? Should I not react? Verse 10, the mountains will take up a weeping and wailing for the habitations of the wilderness, a lamentation, because they are burned up so that none can pass through them. Neither can men hear the voice of the cattle, but the fowl of the heavens and the beasts are fled. They are gone. I will make Jerusalem heaps, a den of dragons. I will make the city of Judah desolate and without inhabitant. Who is the wise man that may understand this? And who is he to whom the mouth of the Lord hath spoken that he may declare it? For what the land perisheth and is burned up like a wilderness that none passeth through. The Lord saith, because they have forsaken my law, which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, neither walked therein, but have walked after the imagination of their own heart, and after Balaam, which their fathers taught them. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood, and give them water of gall to drink, and will scatter them also among the heathen, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, and I will send a sword after them till I have consumed them. This passage is very simple. This is the way the people have been, so this is how God must respond. The destruction is purposely there. It's not accidentally there. The things that are happening around them and the nations that are consuming them are not outside of God's control. God is allowing them. And he says many people have a hard time understanding it, but he says this is what happened. I told you what to do to be blessed, and you didn't do it. You have forsaken my law. And he says, so those who have understanding will see it. That follows. But the world sees every bad thing that happens in our life as God's fault and not ours. I read an article. It's a brief article. It was written in 2005, January, I think, which is actually very ironic because of Hurricane Katrina that happened in 2005. But you'll see why in a second. Her name was Heather McDonald. The article was primarily about the problem of evil. The problem of evil is simply this. It's the issue with apologetics that the world brings up. The biggest argument against the existence of a good God is that there's so much evil and suffering in the world. It's not really that hard of a logical problem, but it's a very much of an emotional problem because every one of us has dealt with things, haven't we? We have a family member who has cancer. Somebody died early. Bad stuff has happened. Just turn on the news tomorrow. We deal with the problem of evil in our world. But usually what's interesting is that atheists try to use the problem of evil to say that God doesn't exist. How could he exist? Because if he did exist, he wouldn't allow it. This is happening, so he must not be there. Which doesn't follow, but that's a different conversation. This was an odd article, because I think she was trying to use it at, like an atheist, but the whole thing was based upon the premise as if God was there. Basically, she said this, constantly we're dealing with things. Constantly we're having natural disasters and diseases and whatever. And every time something big happens, what takes place? Everyone goes to church. Everyone praises God again. Everyone prays. Everyone sings. And then bad stuff happens again. So, this is the article. You can read it. It's Heather McDonald, 2005. Has God Gone Too Far This Time, I think is the name. So she said, apparently that's not working, is it? Because God knows that every time he brings a natural disaster, everybody's going to come and worship him. So they said, let's try it differently this time. Instead, next time there's a natural disaster, no one go to church. No one worship him. No one sing. No one pray. And then God will think, maybe I have gone too far. She said this way, so let the human race play hard to get. She says at the end of her article, it might not work, but the I'm rotten and you're divine syndrome isn't too functional either. It's worth a try. This is how she finished. There is nothing to lose. Foolish. Yeah, even if the picture that she painted of God were true, that God was just malicious, the best way to get his favor is not to stop acknowledging him being there. The fact is, it isn't even true. But see, this is the mindset of our world. When we don't want to mourn for our sin, we want to redefine our sin, we're not at fault. So who's at fault? God's at fault. So when we read this passage like Jeremiah just gave us, who's bad? Me? No, I'm fine. I just made mistakes in my life. God is malicious because he's trying to destroy me. And so we do not understand the judgment of God. This is what she said. I don't know if this doesn't make any sense. So her reaction is to push it away, not turn to him. Let me read a verse at the end of this chapter, really briefly. We're going to get to it in just a second. Verse 24, it says this. Let him, chapter 9, verse 24, let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, watch, which exercised loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things do I delight, saith the Lord. God is a God of judgment and righteousness, and also of loving kindness. But if we refuse to mourn over our sin, then every time God lifts his hand of protection and blessing from us, we immediately begin to paint God as if he is our enemy, as he's purposefully doing things to us so that we'll worship him more. But when we mourn over our sin, we will recognize that we are at fault, and then we understand the judgments of God. We see what God is doing. See the world through God's eyes rather than our foolish eyes, the way we want to paint the world. Number four, when we mourn over our sin, we will see mourning as necessary. Necessary. This is a brief point, but I want to see it as we go by. Verse 17, thus saith the Lord of hosts, chapter 9, verse 17, consider ye and call for the mourning women, that they may come, and send for cunning women, that they may come. And let them make haste and take up a wailing for us, that our eyes may run down with tears and our eyelids gush out with waters. A voice of wailing is heard out of Zion. How are we spoiled? We are greatly confounded because we've forsaken the land. Our dwellings have cast us out. Yet hear the word of the Lord, O ye women, and let your ear receive the word of his mouth. And teach your daughters wailing, and everyone his neighbor lamentation. For death is come up into our windows and entered into our palaces to cut off the children from without and the young men from the streets. Speak, thus saith the Lord, even the carcasses of men shall fall as dung upon the open field and as the handful upon the harvest man, and none shall gather them. So not only is Jeremiah mourning for the people, and the people are mourning over their situation, but in this passage, God himself commands them to mourn for what's going on. Why? Because part of restoration is acknowledging and confessing that our lives are not what they should be. So he says, you must mourn if you are to change. So teach them mourning. What we teach our people, we teach our people to try to think that everything's okay. The world teaches us to redefine everything as it's fine. I'm fine. I am what I am. I am who I am. And it's okay. And so we train our brains to not see it for the way that it is. And he says, no, we need to teach ourselves. We need to teach ourselves to see sin as sin and to be bothered by it. We need to teach ourselves to do that. So mourn. That's necessary. I'm not going to read the whole passage. In 1 Corinthians, I've already given it to you before, so it's not a brand new principle. When Paul writes the book of 1 Corinthians, he's really pointed and harsh about like everything. everything you could possibly do wrong, Corinth was doing wrong. There was fornication, there was bad doctrine, there was pride, there was selfishness, there was sectarianism, and he has to deal with all of it, one after another. He's really pretty pointed. And they dealt with it. And in 2 Corinthians, he writes to them in chapter 7, and he says that, I felt bad because I was really mean, but I don't feel bad that you had to be sorry, because godly sorrow worketh repentance, he says. And he says, so your reaction, because you were sorry, because you mourned over all the things you were doing wrong, which was a long list, you had zeal, you had vehement desire to change. If you don't mourn over your sin, you're not going to have a vehement desire to be godly. You're going to have a half-hearted response that maybe you should do better soon. Mm-hmm. And then you never get around to it because it's not important. When something's bad in your house, when something breaks, a water line breaks in your basement and your basement starts to fill with water, you have a vehement desire to fix it. Why? Because it's a problem. But when that piece of baseboard in your kitchen gets kicked by your kids and it's just kind of peeling away from the wall a little bit, and you say to your wife, yeah, I'll fix that soon. It's not a big problem, so you don't deal with it. It takes 3 years for you to get around to nailing that piece of baseboard back onto the wall, doesn't it? Because it's not a big deal. The more you paint your sin as not a big deal, the less likely you are to actually change. Mourning is necessary. I got to give you the last 2 points, but they're really quick because there's 2 verses. Number 5, when we mourn over our sin, then we will cease to see ourselves as the answer. When I want to say my sin's not so bad, then I can say I can fix it because I'm okay. So this is what he said at the end of this section. Verse 23, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. They didn't want to mourn because they're trying not to think there was a problem. They could handle it. They didn't want to break down and lose hope. They wanted to fix it because we have wisdom, we have might, we have riches, we can deal with all of the onslaught of the world. And this is our immediate reaction to our life. I mean, suppose you went home this week and your budget didn't quite balance, right? What's your initial response? You drop on the floor in the fetal position and rock back and forth and weep uncontrollably. That's what you do. Now, some of you are thinking, I did that one time, and I probably shouldn't do that in the future. No, what do? You get out your receipt. You get out your book, you get out your budget, and you sit down at the table with a pen and paper, and you figure it out like an adult. I'll deal with it. But spiritually, we do the same thing. Our hearts are not right, and so what are we going to do? Well, we're not going to drop down to the ground and weep uncontrollably. We're going to deal with it. We'll fix it like an adult. Sit down, I'll evaluate my life, and I'll figure it out. Because I got wisdom, I got might, because some of us have never dropped to our knees and wept uncontrollably about our sin. Once, because we're adults. But he says, don't glory in your wisdom, and don't glory in your might, and don't glory in your riches, because those aren't going to help you. Sometimes you need to mourn over where your life is. Because when you mourn, number 6, that is when we take a step toward knowing God more. He finishes all of this. He says, don't glory in your might or your wisdom or your riches. Verse 24, but let him that glorieth, what's important? What do I elevate? Glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me. That I am the Lord which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight. In mourning, we distance ourselves from sin. We separate ourselves. We sanctify ourselves. We call sin what it is. That's confession. We understand the judgment of God. We see mourning as necessary. We see God as the answer and not me. Then we begin to see God for who he is. And that is the goal. God, we have stopped seeing God for who he is, and so God needs to bring us back to it. But if we refuse to see the world the way that God sees it, then we're refusing to see God for who he is and the way he wants us to see him. And so he says, if we mourn for our sin, which is uncomfortable, if we do that, then we begin to take a step toward knowing him more honestly. But when we try to paint our situation better than it really is to make ourselves feel better, we have to redefine and cloud our vision of God, and we just take another step away. Jeremiah says, rather than just thinking it's okay, let's be bothered when our lives are not what they should be, because that's a step toward him.